This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The literature and movies of the 20th century often look to the future for action and characters. The Martian Chronicles by famed author Ray Bradbury imagined a Mars with canals and Martian natives. And movies like 2001, A Space Odyssey, foresaw advances in technology that sometimes had unexpected consequences, like a paranoid, homicidal computer named HAL. Still other science fiction stories predicted technologies that would one day actually exist. Just think of the communicator on Star Trek. Looks an awful lot like a flip phone, doesn't it? Well, today we're going to take a look at books and movies of the century past and how they view the future. A little later on, we're going to talk with some NC State professors on cutting edge of today's futuristic technology. But right now, we have Devin Orgeron. He's an associate professor at North Carolina State's Film Studies Department. He joins us in the studio. Welcome, Devin. Good
Thanks,
to have
Frank.
You here. And also joining us is Tony Daniel, an editor at Bain Books, noted publisher of science fiction and author. His newest book, Guardian of Night, should be on the shelves by February 7th. Tony, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hello.
Taking your phone calls and emails as well, 877-962-9862-SOT@WUNC.org. Were you influenced by a vision of the future, something you read about or saw on the big screen? How did science fiction affect you? Did you have a vision yourself and you want to share it? Give us a call, 877-962-9862. Tony, how long has science fiction been imagining, in literature anyway, the way the future would look?
Well, I mean, science. Many people put the first science fiction novel at Frankenstein, but I would say it really took off in the 20th century. It's the creation of the 20th century, and particularly the modern science fiction was a product of men going off to and women going off to World War II and coming back. Before that, we had the Flash Gordon stuff, and then after that, we had an editor named John Campbell who came along and sort of created the idea of fiction that was really about something that we could imagine the future really becoming and being. And we had a lot of people who were a lot more sophisticated coming back from the war, I think. And the short story became the dominant form of science fiction then. We created then, and that was the beginning of Asimov's time. He was a Campbell-related writer, Arthur C. Clarke and Robert A. Heinlein. Those were the big three.
Who came out of them? And it's interesting because the thing about being human is you can think about the future. That's what makes us human. We've been able to do that for a long time. It does seem that technology, industrial technology, is a thing that drove this thing called science fiction.
Yeah, well, it's the experience of being thrown into a gigantic technical machine that World War II was that really set the it made it become a popular form that really had a movement of its own after that.
Devin, what about the movies? When did we start imagining the future on film?
Well, interestingly, I think the story is kind of similar. Actually, the history of cinema is in some ways is bookended by science fiction. I think right around the turn of the century, of course, 1902, Georges Méliès made A Trip to the Moon, which set into motion a few, I think, kind of huge science fiction ideas that would continue through much of the 20th century with regard to how the future and, in particular, space exploration would be envisioned.
And that a lot of it, I'm going to stop you there for a second, because A Trip to the Moon is something that a lot of us have, if you haven't seen the whole thing, you've at least seen one image from that film.
That's true.
That was a film, 1902 French film, and the image that you've seen is the moon, face on the moon, and a giant bullet in its eye.
Right? That's exactly right, yeah. And that image, which has become so iconic, in some ways serves a couple of really important purposes. I feel like one of the things that's really interesting about that film is it makes it's played for laughs, but it makes from the outset the idea of space exploration, the idea of technology more broadly, conquerable. It makes it into something that's manageable by human intelligence. And this is sort of the point at which the film begins. Of course, that hubris, that sense of that ability to conquer something like science and technology comes back to bite the explorers in that film pretty severely. The inhabitants of the moon are none too glad that these explorers have shown up, and they swiftly make sure they go back home. And this sets, as I said, this sets into motion, I think, and this is one way in which I think the literature, science fiction literature, differs really radically from science fiction film. I think there's a more there's a history of a more intense kind of curiosity about science and technology in the literature. I think in the cinematic versions of the same, there's a real skepticism, and a real the films more often than not tend to be kind of warnings about too much curiosity, which I think is a real puzzle.
What do you think about that, Tony? Is that right? You think that literature is a little more, say, open-minded about the future?
Well, what I think is that science fiction has very much split off into two. It's a big field. There's a lot of people from many different viewpoints writing science fiction that love this stuff, and there are people who are the lovers of technology and think that it holds the salvation of the human race, et cetera. And there's those who are extremely skeptical as well. And each are writing their competing visions of the future, as it were. Over particularly the 60s brought in this movement called the New Wave, when people started questioning whether all this technological triumphalism was what we wanted or was going anywhere. So that happened, and then there was a resurgence of the Campbellian sort of that let's go technology stuff, mm-hmm. with writers like Orson Scott Card, people that my company publishes, like David Weber and such. We're pretty much, you know, on the side of technology.
Mm-hmm. So there's a split in the world of literature, but what about film? Film does seem to be more or less stacked against, more warning-oriented, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there are exceptions to this, just like there are with any of these kinds of rules. But I think by and large, and again, I think it has to do with just sort of the legacy of how these ideas have been conveyed cinematically. There's been very little variance. There's been this tendency to sort of to slap the idea of curiosity on the wrist now mm-hmm. and then, particularly this kind of curiosity.
Well, yeah, you know, we talked about 2001, and of course this is I think one of the clips that we're all going to seriously remember in terms of the warning. But again, I mean, we'll do the scope, because 2001 is done toward the end of the 20th century, at the beginning of the 20th century. Same message, you know, mm-hmm. you can get there. Yeah, we can do it, but you're going to have to get yourself off pretty quick, because mm-hmm. Technology is going to come back and get you. But let's listen to this from 2001.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
There we go. A clip from 2001, A Space Odyssey. How important is it in a film like that the technology is correct? And how do film and literature differ in terms of trying to get the science right?
Well, Kubrick, of course, was a real obsessive about a lot of things. But one of the things he was obsessive about was getting, at least to the degree that this was possible, a lot of the science and technology right, or as right as he could. That's not so for the bulk of science fiction film. In fact, the thing that always I marvel at every time I put in any science fiction film, especially from the mid-century, at the absurdity of the gadgetry that's on display, the blinking lights, the buttons that seem to have no particular function, the displays that are displaying just randomly accessing numbers. And it's just
lights going.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's not typically that important to get the technology right. What's important, I think, in some respects, is there's a kind of split in how science fiction film deals with this issue. But very often, and I'm thinking of a film like Forbidden Planet from 1956, the technology is made to look as familiar as it possibly can, as unfrightening, as unthreatening. Forbidden Planet's interesting because the house, I guess you could call it, that Dr. Morbius and his daughter live in is really just this swanked out 1956 ranch house. Yeah. With the kitchen of the future, right? Everything's push button. But none of it, including Robbie the robot, who's kind of the iconic character in that film, none of it is threatening in any way. It's all meant to be sort of palatable and easily digested.
And recognizable, as you said. Yeah. Well, even Star Trek, you know, people think they got it right. The communicators look like flip phones. Right. Yeah. But they could communicate on theirs.
Right.
You
know?
So they got that wrong. We're coming to the end of this segment, Tony, but what about in literature in terms of trying to get it right? Is it more important in books?
Well, it's very important that you get it plausible. Mm-hmm. That's the gold standard you're shooting for in science fiction. You make it seem like it could really be. That's the difference between science fiction and fantasy. I mean, fantasy is logically consistent within its world, but science fiction needs to be consistent within our world so that it seems like it could happen, even though who knows what the future really is, and probably science fiction for the most part is a metaphor for the present to talk, because we're present people reading it. Nevertheless, getting it right is important.
Tell you what, we're going to talk more about this and taking a look at our future from the past. Our guest, Tony Daniel, science fiction writer and editor at Bain Books. Devin Orgeron from the NC State School of Film. Just ahead, what popular predictions of the future got right and wrong about Mars. And your phone calls at 877-962-9862. We'll get to the phones after this break on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking about how literature and movies imagine the future. With us, Devin Orgeron from NC State's Film School. Tony Daniel is a science fiction writer and editor at Bain Books. Taking your phone calls and emails. Phone calls 877-962-9862. Tell us what you imagine the future will be like, what you imagined it would have been like when you were in the past, and tell us how you think movies and literature got it wrong. And Devin, before the break, you were talking about the movie Forbidden Planet and right. and Robbie the Robot. And we've got a clip now that kind of shows the relationship, who Robbie was. So I want to play that clip and talk about the impact of Robbie the Robot on the future.
Can I be of service, sir?
Look, never mind the sir, mister, but I'm a stranger in this so-called planet. I was just wondering if you could tell me where I could get a hold of some of the real stuff.
Real stuff?
Just for cooking purposes, you understand. I take a big pride in my duties.
Pardon me, sir. Stuff?
Oh, genuine ancient rocket bourbon. See here? Hey! Well, you low-living contraption, I ought to take a can opener to you.
Quiet, please. I am analyzing. Yes, relatively simple alcohol molecules with traces of fusel oil. Would 60 gallons be sufficient?
Gallons? Mister, I've been from here to there in this galaxy, and I just want you to know you're the most understanding soul I ever met up with.
Best robot ever. Right. Devin, what was his influence on the course of science fiction film after that?
Well, I think there was a push, at least graphically, to represent robots in this kind of humanoid shape. And this is something that I think Robbie brings to the role in Forbidden Planet. But I think he's a little unusual in his rather sweet generosity. His ability to produce bourbon makes him a robot that I'd like to have in maps.
Well, again, I think matching what you said earlier, the whole idea that it's got to be familiar. I mean, what is it we want robots to do? And we already know the stuff we'd like to have them do. Well, let's go to the phones, 877-962-9862, talking about what science fiction got right and wrong. Caleb is on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Caleb.
Hi. I was just curious about what the author might have to say about Ray Kurzweil's concept of transhumanism and extending human consciousness into a more eternal state via machines or something like that. I wonder if you think that might be a plausible idea at all.
No, okay. Thanks, Caleb.
Well, this is a big thing at the moment in science fiction, the idea that there's a coming singularity, that there's a moment when AI and humans are going to merge and we're going to reach some kind of techno-transcendent state. And there's many people doing things along those lines. There's a lot of literary science fiction deals with that. It's a fascinating question. My book, Metaplanetary, I wrote a few years ago, talks about the coming of such a moment. The question is whether the computers are going to be, or if, like Arthur C. Clarke has it, when the new breed comes along, they have no use for us. or if we're going to become the new breed, and it is going to be us. And if it is, then we don't have anything really to worry about. And if it's not, then we're going to be left out in the cold and have no purpose.
So it's a giant brain on the cloud. All of our information is uploaded to this thing. And whenever we want information, we just sort of go back to the giant data pool.
Something like that. It's more like it. Progress will become so quick that it will be happening instantaneously. Right. And the knowledge of humanity will become godlike in an instant. And we'll all be part of that. That's the idea of the same. Singularity.
But then it, of course, raises questions about you can talk about all, but then what happens to each? If there's an all and a singularity, then what does it matter if I'm an each? If
that's
I'm
you the stuff me? Of many science fiction novels.
Which leads us to the bigger question. You know, science fiction film, if I had to just do a sort of a brief survey in my own mind, look back over those films, they tend to scare us, be much more emotional. And books tend to, some of the literature, some of it anyway, tends to be more thought-provoking. In other words, there's what happened between the pages, and then there's what you and I talk about after we've read the book. What does it mean to be human if all mentation and thought is somewhere on a computer? Devin, is that a fair characterization that films tend to be less thought-provoking?
I would hesitate to call them less thought-provoking. I think I would get on the side of calling them sometimes at least less thoughtful. This to me is one of the sort of dividing lines between a lot of what has happened in the last 20 years, particularly in the literature, and a lot of what's happened cinematically. I think there has been an emphasis in the films on, as you're I think pointing to, just kind of cheap thrills and really obvious kind of scare tactics. But I think that the need for those cheap thrills and scare tactics tells us something about our culture and tells us a great deal about what it is that we're afraid of. And one of the things that I think we've been afraid of since 1902 are machines and what they're going to hold in store for us in the future.
Yeah. Well, I would differ with that slightly in that, and of course it was a cautionary tale, but mm-hmm. I remember coming out of The Matrix, the first Matrix movie, with a group of my friends. And of course I'd seen all that, and it was old hat to me because it was the cyberpunk stuff from the mm-hmm. 80s made into a movie. But they had never seen these ideas before. And they just couldn't stop talking about it. So I certainly think films can be very thought-provoking on occasion.
2001, good friend of mine is a freelance journalist working on a book that suggests that HAL is really essentially computerized international trading. That financial markets are now based on computerized training. There are algorithms that tell you when to buy, tell you when to sell. The prime directive is rate of return on investment, which may or may not be a human directive. And so there you go. I mean, HAL is a very thought-provoking mm-hmm. Character who has consequences for us in the future. Go back to the phones now. Eric is on the line from Durham. Hello, Eric.
Hey, Frank. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for your guests. I'm wondering if they think that if it's any easier, for lack of a better word, for science fiction writers today to sort of extrapolate the future than it was 50 years ago, you know, before the computer revolution.
Okay.
I'll take my call off the air.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks.
Well, I think it. Many of the original science fiction writers, people like, Heinlein was an Annapolis graduate in engineering, and Asimov was a biochemist, and a lot of them already came from a science background. These days, most of the science fiction writers, many of them are scientists, people like Gregory Benford, for instance. But a lot of us aren't, and we are surrounded by science magazines and science popular science shows, and it seeps down to us. They said one time, I believe it's true, that they polled the command center at the Apollo, the first Apollo launch, the moon mission, and everyone in there had been a Heinlein junkie when they were young, reading the Heinlein juveniles. Every guy, they were all guys mm-hmm. at the time, mm-hmm. had been influenced by Heinlein. So I think it all feeds on itself.
Yeah, I think cinematically this story is sort of similar. I find that we've come well, it depends on how you look at it. I was about to say that we've come a long way from the blinking lights and buttons that do nothing that I was joking about earlier. But where have we gone? We've gone to graphically, giant 3D touchscreens that are available to us technologically, and they're things that we can represent on screen, but their verisimilitude, I think, is still questionable.
Yeah, and questions about what it means for us if we can create avatars, identities, sure. social identities, and even social networks. And Devin, you were talking about this idea that in film we see these primitive species or question whether or not, you know, the role of humanity, what it is to be human. I think maybe Planet of the Apes was one of those films that kind mm-hmm. of that raised that question. Let's hear a clip from Planet of the Apes. And in this scene, a human character played by Charlton Heston is captured by the apes.
Taylor, why did you run away?
Security police.
I'm in charge of this man.
No longer, madam. He is now in the custody of the Ministry of Science.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape.
Oh, there we go. We just want an excuse to play that.
Thank you.
That's all. But that has been a serious question, you know, the reversals. Who's the primitive here and,
sure.
and whether or not we've devolved or evolved and which direction we're going.
Right. I guess cinematically, again, there's been this this trend in science fiction that the more we advance, the more likely we are to just sort of devastate ourselves back to a primitive state. The different filmmakers approach this differently. Some approach it rather romantically and suggest that this primitive state is maybe a good thing and that doing away with some of this technology might be a good idea. But by and large, I think this has been a real trajectory in science fiction.
Tony, Planet of the Apes was a book before it was a film. A lot of books have made their way into film. How do they translate? What gets changed in general? Is there a way to characterize it?
Well, it can be utterly changed, like Blade Runner. Really, just did a complete different take on Android's story from the original book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. But something like 2001, which I think is the greatest science fiction movie for all its flaws and problems. It started out with Kubrick talking to Arthur Clarke about his story, The Sentinel, which is about an alien intelligence that plants technology within primitive humans. And it just developed from there. The book actually was written after the movie, or the novel was written after the movie as a result of the movie. And I think that both became classics. And if you can get that kind of synergy, you can get something great happening.
Mm-hmm. Mars has always captured our imagination, or at least for a long, long time in the history of science fiction. And, of course, it's also the stuff of science fact. Right now, I want to bring into the conversation Andre Mazzolini, who is an associate professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at NC State, and he has worked on Mars rover technology. Andre, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. So a lot of movies and books have taken us to Mars. We have made it there, at least mechanically. But humans haven't been there yet. Why not?
I think it's just a matter of there's a lot of things you need to understand about Mars before you can actually send people there, just in terms of we don't even know a lot about the Mars atmosphere. So when you're going to be talking about, you know, landing people on Mars and taking a spacecraft down through the atmosphere, you have to have a really good understanding of the Martian atmosphere and winds and everything before you can do that. So there's a lot of kind of technical challenges in terms of just being able to safely land people there. In terms of the basic technologies, though, in terms of getting there, you know, that it pretty much all exists. I mean, you know, I think it's more a matter now of kind of a national will to spend the resources it would take to get there. But I don't think there's any real showstoppers in terms of getting there. But I do think it would take, you know, 20 or 30 years after we decided to go to be able to make it.
How long is the trip?
The trip is about 8 months to get there.
And tell us about your work on rovers.
Well, at NC State, we've been working on kind of a different type of Mars rover. The traditional rovers that you see on Mars are the wheeled variety, and they land, and they're very capable, and they can do very fine, precise work, but they can't travel that far. The Spirit and Opportunity rovers, which have been up there for about 6 years now, or maybe even 8 years for one of them, I think the total they've traveled about 34 kilometers between the two.
Why
of them.
Is that? What limits them?
Just because they're small, you know, in terms of the, you know, they just don't travel that fast. So what we've been looking at is a concept called the Mars Tumbleweed Rover, which are big. There's two models. One is a big inflatable sphere The other one is it's spherical in shape, but it's kind of got a wireframe and three orthogonal sails within it. And the idea is the wind would blow these around. They have to be very large because the atmosphere on Mars is so thin. It's about equivalent to Earth at about 100,000 feet. So they need to be about 6 meters in diameter. But you could probably pack, you know, 20 of them into a payload shroud. And the idea is that the wind would blow these around the surface of Mars, and you could travel hundreds of kilometers. And they would be fairly hard to control, but we know so little about Mars that we don't really necessarily even care where they go.
Yeah, it doesn't matter where they go because it's all going to be interesting. But in terms of controlling the stuff inside, I mean, you're going to measure stuff, and you've got this tumbling weed, so you need some kind of gyroscopic, I guess, control to orient
everything.
Well,
what you can do is you can start and stop these. The inflatable version, you would stop it by partially deflating it, and then it would stop. And then the one with the sails, you would just partially fold up the sails, and then they would stop. So you'd be monitoring where they are, and when you want to take measurements, you stop them, and you take measurements, atmospheric data, magnetic measurements, soil samples, whatever you want to do. And then when you want to take off again, you reinflate them or redeploy the sails.
Well, someday humans may very well set foot on the planet Mars. And if they do, Warren Jasper and Brent Carter might be able to help us survive. Warren is a professor in the College of Textiles at NC State University. Brent is a student in the College of Textiles. And they work together on a project to develop habitat for people so that they could survive an extended stay on Mars. Warren is joining us by phone. Brent is here in the studio. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Hi, thank you.
Warren, tell us about your work and Habitat for People on Mars. What are you working on?
Well, it was a senior design project. There's a group. There's a competition called RASCAL, RASC-AL. It's a yearly competition throughout the country. And we got there were four aerospace engineers and three textile engineers worked on it for a year for their senior design competition. They designed a Martian habitat. That was the one of the design goals, and one of the challenges there is when you launch a rocket up, you need something which is sort of tall and thin, but when you want to get a habitat, you want something which is sort of short and fat, and so you need an inflatable is one technique you can use that you can change the shape of things.
Right, and so textiles a pretty good medium, something you can fold up. Brent, what are some of the practical problems that humans would face if they wanted to move around on the surface of Mars?
Well, the atmosphere of Mars is mostly carbon dioxide. So, you know, first of all, you need air to breathe, and you have to have some way of containing that, whether in a spacesuit or if you have a habitat, you need to have air inside.
Another 30 years, we can experience that right here on Earth.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The atmosphere is really low pressure, too. So you would need to be pressurized. So if you have a conventional solid material habitat, it's going to be pressurized anyway. So we thought, you know, why not make something that's fabric-based and inflatable so that you can make it larger when it's on the surface rather than when it's in the spacecraft.
Any old fabric work, or do you have to worry about radiation and some other considerations?
There are a lot of other considerations. Radiation is one of those. You also have to have a really high-strength material because it's a huge pressure differential. So it's like a balloon that's under a huge amount of pressure. So it has to be really strong. It has to protect them against radiation. There's a lot of thermal changes. It gets really cold, then it gets really hot, and you know, materials expand and contract. So there's a lot of different considerations.
So were you working with material that we already know about, or did you have to synthesize your own
fabric? A little bit of both. There's a lot of research out there into materials that offer radiation protection because there's a lot of uses for that. One of the materials we looked into was called Dimron, and they actually used it in suits, hazmat suits, for the cleanup of the nuclear reactors in Japan. And it's a pretty cool material, but it's kind of like neoprene, a rubbery material, but it offers the protection of lead. It's pretty cool.
Substantially lighter, I assume. Mm-hmm. Warren, of course, it's going to be important, I suppose, to find material on Mars. I mean, is that true, and is that something that you're looking at? Do we have to figure out what's there to know what we could use to make stuff once we get there?
Yeah, the in situ utilization is a term that people use stuff that's there. One thing that the team looked at was using regolith, which is sort of like Martian dirt, to make sort of like sandbags that they would put on top of the habitat to protect from radiation. The radiation there typically is about 20 times that on the Earth, but it could spike to as much as 3,000 times Earth levels, which would be lethal. So it's really important to get some kind of radiation shielding. But one of the problems with that is you need a lot of mass and a lot of weight, and it's very expensive to take that over. So one of the things they were looking at was using Martian soil as a sort of a protective barrier on top.
Well, Brent and Warren, I want to thank you both for being on the program today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Pleasure.
Warren Jasper is a professor in the College of Textiles at NC State University. Brent is a student in the College of Textiles. We're talking about conceptions of the future in literature and books and also in the academy. And just ahead, we'll speculate about what the future really holds. We're going to take your phone calls as well at 877-962-9862. Stay with us on the State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour about how literature and movies have viewed the future, exploring the reality of our cutting-edge knowledge about the planet Mars. In the studio, Andre Mazzolini is an associate professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at NC State. Devin Orgeron is at NC State. He's in the film school. And Tony Daniels, a science fiction writer and editor at Bain Books. Taking your phone calls as well at 877-962-9862. Emails, sot@wnc.org. What are your thoughts about the future? How much did science fiction affect you? How much do you think they got right? Andre, in terms of some of the things that we've seen in the films, let's talk about sort of the orbiting space station, in a sense, that in 2001. I mean, how much of that is possible, and how do we really achieve that, for instance, just as an example?
Well, the space station in 2001 is a really interesting example, because there's a scene in there where one of the astronauts is jogging on the inside of a very large rotating gymnasium. And the idea there is, if you have a rotating structure, you have, you know, artificial gravity is generated, just similar to the carnival rides when you're riding and they spin around and the floor drops out and you're kind of plastered against the wall. And it turns out that the current architectures for going to Mars and sending humans to Mars would involve artificial gravity generated by the same principle but in a very different way. And what you would have is, you'd have the crew capsule attached via a long tether, about 2 kilometers long, to a ballast mass, which would probably be like a spent booster rocket. If you take that system and you rotate it very slowly about its center of mass, say, you know, less than 1 RPM, you generate the same type of artificial gravity you get in that huge space station, but obviously at, you know, a very small fraction of the amount of mass it would take to build a big space station.
You wouldn't need that much, because there's no gravity, so you've got to have a lot of mass in order to generate the...
Yeah, you've got to have rotation in order to generate artificial gravity, and we really need artificial gravity in an 8-month trip to Mars, or you're going to lose a lot of muscle mass, bone mass, and so forth.
Let's go back to Ray Bradbury's, series, The Martian Chronicles, Tony. For Ray Bradbury, it was important to use what we knew about science at the time. So he was working with current scientific data to create those stories. Is that right?
Sure. I don't think it mattered that much to Ray Bradbury. Bradbury was Campbell hated him, by the way, and he hated Campbell. Bradbury was much more interested in the poetry of the stuff. And he had there being an atmosphere on Mars that was breathable by humans. We have this entire subgenre in the old days of planet stories, where Venus had rain clouds and such. And on Mars, he had Martians as well, who were, sentient creatures that we went and sort of colonially pushed out of the way in over the course of the Martian Chronicles stories.
They might still be there. They're just
yes,
on the ground.
That's right. That's right.
But
they're
he also had...
For us to...
And so what do we know, Andre, now about the surface of Mars?
My understanding is that currently we believe that at one time Mars did have flowing water on its surface. And so there are evidence of creek beds and river beds and so forth, and a lot of evidence of the same type of geological features you see on the Earth. The most recent, I think it was the Mars Phoenix mission, actually dug below the surface and found permafrost. So we believe there's a lot of frozen water beneath the surface. So there's been no detection yet of any kind of microbial life. But I think that's kind of the next big thing, that the next, like the Mars Science Lab, which is the big spacecraft to go to Mars, is going to look for is evidence of some kind of microbial life there.
Devin, as we get into the 21st century, have films, do you think, changed in the way they're looking at the future?
I think what's interesting to some degree is how much
they've stayed the same. I mean, I like the fact that Tony brought up the Matrix as a real kind of breaking point in some ways. But I think the bulk of science fiction films still imagine this kind of the situation where either we're visiting other planets to find civilizations that have devastated themselves, and they're supposed to be a metaphor for what we're about to do to ourselves, mm-hmm. or said visitors come to our planet to colonize because they've messed up their planet.
Now, The Man Who Fell to Earth, which is in the 1970s, yeah. that was kind of an interesting turnabout and gave us a chance to look at ourselves in a different way.
Absolutely. I mean, that I think that film in some ways was part of a larger category of films that had this kind of eco-science fiction angle. And it's a film, of course, that imagines an explorer or an investigator coming to this planet to find resources to send back to his planet in exactly the way that I've just summarized, that his planet has been devastated by some unknown event.
Gives us a chance to take a second look at our own place. Tom is on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Tom.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was thinking about a couple things, movies and how they do, science fiction movies and how they do and don't get things right. When I was taking the States, me, but when I was driving, taking driver's ed in 74, we had this great Disney film. It wasn't science fiction, but it was a film about the interstates. And they said by 1974, we should be flying in anti-magnetic levitation cars. That great Disney, you know, animation, yeah. picking oranges or something. And then I was thinking with regards to what you're talking about how they do and don't predict the future, think about 2001 or Soylent Green or even the great one with Harrison Ford y'all mentioned.
Blade Runner.
But nobody got the cell phone. Nobody figured out cell phones. In Soylent Green, there's Charlton Heston on the call box.
Well, I mean, Star Trek, sort of, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I'll take the comments off the air. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, I guess the missing cell phones in science fiction are one of the great tragedies of the genre.
I came over here with my jetpack. I don't know about that. But this goes back to what I was saying before, that I think that science fiction is really, really about the present, ultimately. And we need to make it. We need to bring in future plausibility. We need to make it match up with what could happen scientifically. But we're really talking about things that are going on today when we write science fiction, because we're writing for people who are alive now, not people that are alive in the future.
Well, and the best writers have some sense of social, political, and economic because impact and structures, because that's the stuff we're interested in. Otherwise, it would be a list of possible gizmos.
Right. And all joking aside, I think that even though cell phones as such might not have occurred very frequently in science fiction, there is a real obsession with communication technologies since the beginning of science fiction, at least cinematically.
877-962-9862 if you want to join our conversation today. Larry is on the phone from Pittsburgh. Hi, Larry.
Hello. One thing, it was Edward G. Robinson's last movie, I believe, Soylent Green.
Yeah.
But the one thing I wanted to talk about was the China Syndrome. I went to see the premiere in New York when it came out, and then within a month, maybe 2 months, then we had Three Mile Island.
Yeah, that's right.
And also another one that Ray Bradbury, I think it was Ray Bradbury's Illustrated Man, where there was technology had made labor almost non-existent, so people had to split jobs, and one day everybody had to take a pill at night, and either you wake up dead or you wake up alive, and if you didn't take the pill, you would be hunted down and killed because there was too many people and not enough things to do.
We're getting to that point with productivity, too. Thanks, Larry. We're talking about settling for 7% unemployment, the 80-20 split. Could we get to a point where only we can do what we're doing now with only 20% of the labor force? It's a real serious consideration. I mean, all of that stuff is,
I think as important as science fiction's predictive capacity, I think, is its ability to react to things that are actually happening in our culture. I think Tony summarized that idea when he said it's very much about now.
Well, you know, and we also talk about what we'd have to do, Andre. I mean, technologically, how we create a habitat in a place that we know doesn't support human life. We think about what human life is. Let's make the habitat. The alternative is to do something with the human being. to somehow modify human beings so that they can tolerate. You talked about muscle and bone loss in low gravity. Is there something we can do genetically to create beings who can tolerate outer space travel and different environments?
I guess I'd look at it from a slightly different perspective and kind of go back to a comment I think that was made earlier, and that is, if we're going to travel to other places, how do we make use of what's there? For example, what Dr. Jasper was saying. And for example, if you look at Mars, one of the things that Mars has is a CO2 atmosphere. And so when the current Mars architecture says, okay, well, rather than bringing everything you need with you, what you do is you just bring hydrogen. And then what you can do is take that hydrogen and you react it with the CO2 in the Martian atmosphere. And there's a reactor called the Sabatier reactor, and it splits this carbon dioxide and hydrogen mixture together into water and methane. And now you have the methane, which you can use for fuel, and now you have the water, which you can drink, or you can split it, that water, into hydrogen and oxygen. You breathe the oxygen, and then you can take that hydrogen again and continue to mix that with the CO2 and continue. So I think that living off the land approach is really interesting. And actually, if you go back toward the exploration of the poles and the Northwest Passage, Amundsen, the great explorer, that's why he was successful in exploring the Northwest Passage, is because rather than bring everything with him, he decided, well, I'm going to do the way the Inuit peoples did, and I'm going to shoot caribou on the way and so forth, and make use of what's there rather than this idea I have to bring everything with me. So I think if we're really going to ultimately colonize planets and so forth, what we really need to do is figure out how do we make effective use of what the resources that are there.
And is this generator that you talked about that can create methane and water?
Right.
I mean, is that available to us now?
In fact, that project that Dr. Jasper is talking about, the joint project between the aerospace engineering and textile engineering, one of the things these students did actually is they actually built a working reactor that took carbon dioxide and hydrogen and split it apart. So that's a very well-known reaction, and we have working ones right now.
Well, I can imagine that at NC State they don't want to work too much on modifying human beings for space travel, or at least talk about it here. But
Not in the English department.
How has film and literature treated that question, Devin?
Well, it's interesting. I actually think that to some degree we're experiencing changed human beings. I think the way human beings interact with the technologies that are at their disposal presently is a form of evolution. I think that in some ways we all kind of behave robotically. We have these kinds of attachments to our technologies that, though not biological yet, they have changed the way we behave. They changed the way we think, and they've changed the way we communicate.
We have one of our writers at Bain, Lois Bujold, has envisioned a genetically engineered sort of human that she calls quaddies, I believe, and they have feet for their hands and feet for their – I mean, no, I'm sorry, hands for their feet and hands for their hands, and so they have – the ability to grasp and go around in free fall.
Extra thumbs, I hope, to
and
work.
Yes, and they've developed an entire culture based on, just being different and being treated differently by others around them as well, in a good and bad way.
Go back to the phones. One last call. Richard is on the line from Durham. Hi, Richard.
Hi. On the cell phone, apologies in advance. Two things I was thinking about the sense in which what futures we can predict come from what technology we can imagine. I was reminded by the earlier caller about missing cell phones, about the great master John Bruner, whose stand on Zanzibar still sounds like it could be set 20 years in the future after 50 years. Mm-hmm. And he sees the internet
original
coming
cyberpunk
in that, but he doesn't see the personal computer. Hmm. So everybody has to get centralized data instead of being able to get from one computer to another. And I'm wondering, in terms of what futures we can envision now, this idea of the singularity brings us a new vision of artificial intelligence as being not that we create a machine that is conscious, but that we create a machine that is created from a human consciousness. I know that Tony Daniel is among several writers who've really explored that. I feel like it's starting to become a consensus the way the Venusian jungle did with Cory Doctorow and Charles Stross and that whole crowd. And is there something that how many orders of magnitude do people who thought about that among the guests, how many orders of magnitude of technology are we away from being able to see that happening?
All right. Thanks, Richard.
This is a science fiction reader. If he's read me, he's delved deep in the genre.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It who knows? But we're certainly working on with the advances in nanotechnology, and I think that this very interesting new the idea of scaling quantum physics effects up to macro level, producing quantum computers and things like instantaneous transfer of information is it's conceivable now. It's not magic, at least. It's something that seems like it could be plausible. I make it plausible in my new book, by the way. and if we can do that, then we can copy a human consciousness onto something else. It's because that's very, very complex. We're not even close, of course, in real life to AIs. If you ever talk to a chatbot, you know how stupid they really are. In 2 minutes, you can tell you're talking to an idiot. Yeah. But
I would say insert joke here, and then Devin, go ahead.
Well, the only thing that I can come up with is that the recent the sort of experiment on Jeopardy of having a kind of robotic contestant, and I think it sort of underscored this idea that we've still got a long way to go before we can sort of replicate what we consider to be human intelligence.
Andre, want to take that one? Because another part of that question is, to what extent does science fiction influence science and technology in the academy?
I think it's really hard to predict. I think we get used to these rates of increase, and then we extrapolate. And I'm not sure that that's always, you know, for example, if you look, most of us when we were in growing up in the 60s and 70s, we thought we'd have flying cars by now. And air travel and automobile travel is basically unchanged in 40, 50 years. And so I think it's highly possible that other technological advances that we think are going to continue on this breakneck speed, we never know when they may level off. And so something like AI, I think it's really just completely unknown. But I think there's a tendency of us to always assume that the rate of change we're experiencing is going to continue, and that's not always the case.
And sometimes there are barriers that are not technological, social, political, and economic barriers to various strands of technology. So that's all enters in. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Andre Mazzolini is an associate professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at NC State. Devin Orgeron is an associate professor at NC State's Film Studies Department. Tony Daniel is a science fiction writer, editor at Bain Books. His new book, Guardian of Night, comes out February 7th. Thank you all for being on the show.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Before we go, I want to tell you that Jade City Pharoah returns next Thursday. Things are starting to get hot for our superhero, Harold M.F. Jones, in his battle with his nemesis, the Beef Cooker. Jade City Pharoah returns Thursday at noon. If you want to catch all the episodes, go to stateofthings.org. Go to kickstarter.com if you want to see the series continue and help us with our Kickstarter campaign. Type Jade City into the search field at kickstarter.com and keep Harold M.F. Jones flying. Thanks for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.